Underground Comics, Episode 6.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Around Comics, where every week we assemble a new panel to discuss topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman. Let me introduce you to this week's panel. On your iPod, from left to right, as always, he is my partner in crime and the producer of the show. He is Brian Salazar.
Hello again, everyone.
And next, a guest that has been here so often that we have started to charge him rent. He is Thomas Caters.
Salutations.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. On this week's episode, it is starting a big four-week event for us. We are going to deconstruct the happenings around comics. On this week's episode, we're going to take a look at the state of the DC universe. Now, Thomas is our resident DC expert, so we're going to lean on him a lot today. DC has been very aggressive in pulling together the continuity of their universe in the last, really, 2 years. But, Tom, I wanted to start off with you. What do you see as the real starting point for DC's infinite push?
It's actually, to already begin my complicated answers to things, there's kind of two ways of looking at it. One would be Identity Crisis would be a real good place to start, I think. It definitely would get across a lot of the themes that have been running through all the books since that point, so that would be a good starting point. But in another way, the real starting point is the original Crisis on Multiple Earths. And as much as DC wants this to be, like its own story, I think knowledge and having read the original Crisis definitely would make reading this one more enjoyable.
Well, sure. You look at the universe right now, and Infinite Crisis is not only a major nod back to Crisis on Infinite Earths, but it is really, I don't know if it was planned this way, probably not, but they've done a wonderful job of tying the two mega events together on the anniversary. Sal, I know that you've been keeping up with quite a bit of the minis. What is the one thing that DC has done that you're probably most impressed with in the last couple of years?
Well, I think they've realized some of the problems that they were getting themselves into again, and they wanted to do this big event, obviously, but I think they also learned from their mistakes last time with Crisis, and not trying to reinvent everything. I think they're trying to sort of not, well, I think they're really, their goal here is to try and reestablish characters and the world and certain characters, specifically Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, and not break it all down, tear it down, and start from scratch all over again. So I'm really impressed with their ability to, hype it a lot and get a lot of people excited about it, but at the same time keep the quality there and keep, I think, most people happy with what they've done as far as respecting what's gone on in the past, yet trying to move forward with something, completely different. Because it's difficult to do. I mean, you look at the original Crisis, and it had so many people up in arms because of what they were trying to accomplish and the way they were going about it. Wiping out all these other Earths and such. I think they tried to learn from that, and they're trying to do this huge event and really move forward with and set things straight in the universe, but not wipe it clean kind of attitude.
I agree partially, but I also would say that in retrospect, one of the criticisms of the original Crisis is that they didn't go all the way. They didn't completely redo everything. And with this event And you can't, it's beyond an event. With this restructuring of the universe, I think they're going all the way. And that is exciting. Tom, what has been your favorite part of the DC universe as a whole in the last couple of years?
Well, I've been a really
And you can't say the Flash.
I was gonna say Flash, but I was gonna say something else besides that too. I think, and it ties into what I think they're doing the best at with this whole crisis, is I've always really enjoyed the JSA book a lot, because I feel one of the strengths that DC has been playing towards is finding these characters who might have a very complicated past, and you don't need to erase the past to make them simple, you just need to find what makes that character what that character is now. You know, but with the JSA, I mean, if you really wanted to look at their history, I mean, you know, your head would explode if you're trying to figure out where, trying to tie in stuff that happened in the past into the current and how they fit in now as opposed to how they fit in pre-crisis. But you can forget that when people write stories that draw you to the now instead of drawing you the past constantly. So I always hold it up as one book that's done such a great job for DC of showing how rich of a history they have.
Absolutely. And one thing that I look at in the DCU, growing up as a Marvel fan, being a huge fan of X-Men, at the time, DC was always the company that made the books for kids. And if you wanted to read the more mature titles, then you read Marvel. Now, I see that DC as a universe is just as much for adults, for the 20-something, 30-something, 40-something comic fans. And I think that really in the last 2-3 years, they have done an amazing job of making just good comics that appeal to a lot of people. Agree or disagree?
I think that's exactly how I felt about him when I was a kid. But I was a kid, so I liked it. And then over the years, as I dropped in and out, I picked up DC stuff here and there. And I used to really enjoy the old Justice League Giffen stuff. And then I dropped out of comics for a while. And I thought DC was horrendous for a while in the mid-90s. And it's just amazing to me how the quality of just about everything they've done for the last couple of years has been really high. Everything's really readable, and you know, with how the universe is going to be after this, I think it's going to be a really neat place to start reading DC if you haven't been.
Absolutely, and I'll throw this one Sal's way. It looks like with Infinite Crisis that DC is putting all of the focus back onto the big three. Dan DiDio repeatedly has said that Infinite Crisis is about Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman. Sal, do you think that it is important that DC keeps the focus on the Trinity?
Well, I mean, from a business standpoint, I think it certainly is. Those three characters are what they've been all about for 40 years, 50 years now, I think they always will be. I mean, I think you have to hold on to that iconic status of those three characters. I think people will know those. I think people will know about Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, 100 years from now. And I think you have to certainly hold on to that and try and keep that going as long as you can.
Is that the foundation that the rest of the universe has to stand on top of?
Well, the thing that DC is doing now, what I have enjoyed the most in the last few years of what they've done is really sort of pay off long-time readers. If you look at, Infinite Crisis and that, the more knowledge you have about the history of the DC universe, the more you're going to get out of that book. And a lot of their other books too. I mean, Jeff Johns is obviously an enormous fan of the characters he's writing and a historian of these characters, and puts so many things in the books that he writes, and it sort of filter down into a lot of the other stuff that he doesn't do. But as a, I think as a company as a whole, they've sort of taken that attitude of really trying to infuse it with its rich history, as opposed to trying to ignore it or make it go away.
Not be embarrassed by it.
Yeah, exactly. They've used it to their advantage. The only downside of that, I think, is that at some points it gets to be detrimental for any new readers jumping on. I think, you know, for someone, and we talked about this before, someone jumping into that book that isn't a longtime reader of the DCU or doesn't know the history of these characters or hadn't read Crisis initially.
Explain Speed Force to me. Well, I think is what you're getting at.
Yeah, I mean that's you're going to have a hard time with it if you don't know what's going on. But I think they're smart enough to know that too, and I think that's sort of a part of a goal of this whole thing is that to get to a point where you can go forward and have stories that are easily enough accessible for new readers while at the same time hanging on to that iconic status for those characters.
Well, that was going to be the next point I was going to bring up, and I'll throw this one back over to Tom, is that there's a term that's eked its way into comics whenever you're talking about DC, and that's pre-crisis, post-crisis. Do you think that we are set up for a pre-Infinite Crisis, post-Infinite Crisis, as far as, you know, read here, this is a before and after moment?
Ooh, that's interesting.
You know, 15 years from now, are people going to say, well, pre-Infinite Crisis or post-Infinite Crisis, you know, this is how the universe was?
It all depends on how they really go about approaching the whole one-year later situation they're going to go about. Because there's a way you can write these one-year later stories that are a jumping on point, but also just a continuation of what's happened before. And I think we won't really know how we're going to look at it until we've seen how it ends. Because the big difference so far between the original Crisis and this Crisis is in the original Crisis, DC made a much, you know, the huge goal is to bring in all these things that they've had for years, like, you know, Western characters and time traveler characters, and then, you know, get rid of all that. Well, this Crisis has been much more about just strictly the superhero stuff, which is what they've been doing for the last 20 years. So they don't have that same thing to pull from. So it's going to be interesting to see how what's happened in between is going to fit into the history of these characters. You know, what is the real nature of the 1 year later going to be, you know? And I think that's something, just reading the first couple 1 year later books, I don't think we're going to have a pre-Infinite Crisis and post-Infinite Crisis, because these stories are just continuations. In a way, the original Crisis, when you say pre-Crisis, you're talking about something that pretty much doesn't exist anymore in continuity, or however you want to think about it.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I don't think you're going to have that some sort of turning point where everything has changed, you know, so radically that, you know, it's a marking in the history. I think they're using it to clean up and reestablish certain things more so than, you know,
just, you know, wholesale reset.
So as opposed to a invention, it's more of a tidying up of the house.
Well, I mean, if you read a lot of pre-Crisis DC, I mean, they had so much stuff. Because they had that huge explosion in the 70s where they wrote an idea about anything, got a book. And then they had an implosion where all these people got fired. But they had all these characters, and they tried to bring as many of them could into the original Crisis. But it's kind of not the same situation this time. You don't have so much extraneous stuff you're pulling from. I mean, you have your Z-list titans, but you can always rip off a few arms.
Listen to AroundComics.com. It's not just for 12-year-old boys, it's for 13-year-old boys, too.
Okay, on this segment, I want to kind of break down how we've gotten to where we are in the MCU. Now, reading in Wizard Magazine this last month, Geoff Johns talked about the death of Donna Troy being really kind of the kickoff of the whole Infinite Crisis story and how they're tying things together. But I think most people can relate to Identity Crisis as a true event kicking off. Tom, can you give us a quick rundown of what Identity Crisis was about?
Well, all right. It's just a warning. I probably will say something that's a spoiler, so if you haven't read it, get freaked out if you're listening to this, then please ignore me. but basically the theme of it was, it was a major sort of inserting a piece of history into the past of the of the Justice League, that at some point in the past, Dr. Light had attacked Elongated Man's wife, and as a consequence of that, the Justice League had a vote, and they had Satana erase his memory and try and almost lobotomize him into being not a big threat, which is a real interesting twist on why certain villains often did things that were silly and stupid and people couldn't explain. So when I first read it, I was like, oh, what an interesting way of, you know, kind of explaining that. But the main ramification was sort of a rift within the League about how things have been divided out, because they had also erased Batman's memory as well. And at some point during the Batman series, you started to figure out that he has known about it, and that's part of his paranoia is coming from that, because the people he trusted betrayed him and, you know, took part of his mind away. So the big theme in that book is...
It was really the first time I've seen in the DCU that heroes were doing very almost villainous things, and it is also what really started to create a rift between the hero community. And I think that was probably the most important thing about Identity Crisis.
Yeah, it explained a lot of rifts. It explained why Green Arrow doesn't get along with Hawkman. And, things like that. Things that you'd always thought you knew one thing about, but now looking back, you understand a lot better why these characters have acted the way they have.
Now, wasn't there, I think in like Justice League, there was a point where the Secret Society and a bunch of the Justice League characters had like switched...
Yes.
Identities, and that's sort of where this kind of came from in some ways. Zatanna erases their memories the first time, right?
Well, it's kind of an explanation for how villains did all these things in the past that you would think, like, well, don't they know who they are? You know, like, if you switch bodies with the Flash, wouldn't you take the mask off?
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a retconning an explanation for how the Justice League was able to stay hidden for so long.
But it was a very believable retconning, which is hard to find in comics.
Well, it was an interesting... I mean, that was a complete sort of different take on any sort of superhero story in the DCU. You know, with those characters, certainly, it was a much different type of story than I'd ever seen come out of DC before. It set the tone, I think, you know, even though at the time, you know, I didn't know what, you know, they hadn't really started any hyping of Crisis on Infinite Earths, and that just was sort of starting, but it really set the tone for things are going to change. I mean, this is a different sort of world we're looking at here, and things are certainly going to change from this.
I think in retrospect, it is a much stronger book. I remember reading it at the time, and it's like, it's a fun read. It's an interesting murder mystery. But now, you know, what, 5 issues into Infinite Crisis and a year and a half removed, to go back and read Identity Crisis, you're like, oh, wow, they were really thinking about this back then, and they kept it wrapped up, and they really held on to a lot of the build-up.
Yeah, and it spun off into a lot of the other titles as well.
Well, yeah, that's so the next. I mean, that led right into the what they called it the Crisis of Conscience, right? That was in the JLA.
Yeah, well, it dealt with the secret. Well, not the secret society. The Society of Supervillains. Now I'm getting all my societies mixed up. But they come back because I believe Dr. Light tells them what happens, and now they know what has happened to them. And in the end, they end up erasing their memory again.
Well, yeah, actually, it was what's his name? Despero?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's the one that
he had told. I can't remember exactly. He had told them, or they didn't really explain how he knew.
I think he's the one that gave them the memory back.
Yeah, but he gave them their memories back, and then they come out against the League, and they know now. And yeah, at the end of it again, then they, you know, she wipes their memories, and that was sort of the big thing. Is it was, I think it was 4 issues, and like in issue 3, they're debating, they're all sort of voting. Yeah. You know, what do we do now? They had defeated them in a fight, but not, you know, they all knew who they were, and they had their memories back. They knew what had happened, and they knew all of the JLA's identities. So they're sitting there, you know, taking a vote. And that sort of really started the rift. And I think that was the first time that Batman sort of admitted that he knew that they had wiped his memory.
Yeah, well, there's hints and hush at certain points, depending on how you read it. But that was the first time that, probably in a JLA book, that you really saw
that his, you know, just the fact that you see hints to that in Hush, which is a totally unrelated series to Infinite Crisis, to see how widespread the planning has been in them pulling the continuity together of this universe just floors me.
Mm. Yeah,
well, also it's, you know, it's a testament to readers' ability to also potentially invent connections. Because there's things in Hush that definitely could be seen as signs, or it could just have been put in there in the way you read it after reading Identity Crisis. But it definitely says a lot for how skilled they were in putting it together.
Well, moving on from Identity Crisis, and the JLA arc, I think the next major point, there was a 3 issues in Teen Titans, which kind of talked back to the Crisis. But in a future story where the Titans go into the future and meet themselves and all that. But I think the most important next book was Countdown to Infinite Crisis, which for a single issue, it's probably one of my favorite issues of last year.
Well, just real quick, Chris, before we get to that, I just wanted to also mention that at the end of that Crisis of Conscience, we also have the destruction of the JLA watchtower, and what we think—it's
kind of important.
Well, and to go back to that, I mean, at the time, it's Martian Manhunter sitting in the JLA watchtower, and you see on the screens he's watching Superman teleports into the watchtower, and then he turns around and he says, "Wait a minute, you're not," you know. And they don't give it away, but now looking back, we know who it was. Mm-hmm. But once again, it's just one of those things that they were building this all up. You know, and all these writers had this in mind as they were, you know, going for. So I just wanted to throw that in there before we moved on to Countdown.
Which I am a horrible, horrible comic book reviewer person because I haven't read that arc, so I'm going to have to borrow yours.
It's really good. It's much better than the last couple issues of JLA before it stopped.
Yeah, I agree. It was a good little arc.
And I'm going to pick it up. But
filler.
Countdown, which really kind of moved into the whole OMAC project, which, you know, became its own miniseries. It was basically a Blue Beetle story, but I think in retrospect, people are going to look at that and say that may be the greatest Blue Beetle story ever told. I know that Sal is a fan of it. You want to run down Countdown for us?
Sure. Basically, it follows Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle, as he's investigating the disappearance of millions of dollars from his bank account. And he starts this investigation. He tries to get his old friends from the Justice League involved, and they kind of won't even give him the time of day, and you really get the sense of the the pecking.
There's Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, and then there's some of the others. And
yeah, well, even beyond that, I mean, you know, it's like Blue Beetle, as much as, you know, people now have talked about how much they love him and everything. I mean, this really gave you an idea of sort of where he was on the superhero order. But at the same time, I thought it really gave you a great insight to a character, what he could be. Because he goes on and he perseveres regardless of not getting any help from any of the bigger heroes. He ends up uncovering the conspiracy that brings him to Checkmate, or rather it's sort of a secret underground covert government organization that was Checkmate, but now it's being run by the old leader of the Europe,
Maxwell
Lord, which was sort of a funny and ironic thing, because in that book, if anyone's read, JLA Europe, it was all tongue in cheek and very humorous and
very
and
these, Great Lakes Avengers.
Yeah, exactly, and Maxwell Lord was sort of this slick PR guy, you know, almost like a used car salesman sort of character. And now you're seeing him as this ringleader of this, you know, extremely dangerous organization, and he's, you know, sort of psychotic.
They also imply that he purposely kept him inept.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah,
which is debatable about how you feel.
Right, I mean, it is. I mean, the people have gone back and forth on it. And then he, you know, the Blue Beetle ends up infiltrating this organization and finding out that Maxwell Lord is behind a lot of these other things that we've been seeing in the JLA and in Identity Crisis and everything else. And Maxwell Lord catches the Blue Beetle, basically, and threatens him, either join us or die. And as everybody now knows, he refused, and Maxwell Lord blew his brains out. It was, you know, once again, I thought it really set the tone in two ways. Once, you know, one, showing the pecking order of heroes and who was on top and who was on bottom. And obviously the seriousness of what this event was going to be, you know.
It wasn't going to be a hit the reset button event. It's like, okay, you know what? We're going to see some of the heroes that we've come to know and aren't going to be around after this event. And that's what I felt after reading that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it you know, maybe it was a little too graphic. I know there have been people that have complained that, you know, do they really need to vaporize his, you know, head in a full, you know, panel kind of thing. And, yeah, I that's debatable, I suppose.
I think it set the tone. I think you said it perfectly, that that it set the tone for what was getting ready to come. Now, if you don't like the tone that the DCU has taken through this event, you know, that's... it's debatable, but that definitely set it up.
But I did feel that it was, I mean, to me, it was sort of a shame, because it showed what a good writer could do with a secondary character like the Blue Beetle. I mean, that was, to me, that was the best Blue Beetle story I'd ever seen. I mean, granted, the only real Blue Beetle stuff that I'd ever read was the more funny JLA Europe stuff, you know.
He was like a Batman light. In that he was really more of a great detective story, which are the stories I love in Batman. You know, looking at kind of a precursor to that, actually, and touching on how much DC had started to wrap all of the major storylines in, that if anyone remembers the Brian Azzarello run on Superman that Jim Lee was doing pencils on, that was, I look at that as actually a lead into Countdown, because you didn't know it at the time, but that was really an OMAC story.
Yeah, you know, looking back at it now, I mean, I think it was just so darn confusing, like a lot of Azzarello stuff.
That's Azzarello.
that nobody could really tell that until much later. I don't know if that's a bad thing, but I got to say, I didn't really enjoy that storyline. I read it all. After about three issues, I had no clue what was going on, and kind of got bored with it. But looking back at it now, it's just another example of
You take an Azrael story, and then you put in subtle references to an event coming up, and then that will do a really good job of confusing you.
Listen to a RoundComics.com podcast new every Monday. For once, you won't be lying to your parents when you tell them you're not looking at porn.
Kind of moving on and looking at the rest of the DCU, after they left Countdown to Infinite Crisis, we moved into the major miniseries, which were OMAC Project, Days of Vengeance, Rand Thanagar War, and Villains United. And so while all of the other things are going on in the regular DCU, I know that Tom is a big fan of the Rogues War, which I think was going on at the same time. You had these miniseries, which were all leading into Infinite Crisis. We didn't understand why at the time until the last couple issues of Infinite Crisis. But Tom, what was your favorite lead-in miniseries into Infinite Crisis?
Actually, it was Day of Vengeance for me. The major reason why, and I think this is true of all the events that we talked so far about, is what a wonderful job they've done of taking E-list characters that people would, all the way from Hated Man and Identity Crisis to Blue Beetle to people that are in Day of Vengeance are characters.
You're not going to call Detective Chimp a B-list character on me, are you?
No, he's
not on my watch,
A-plus.
Mister.
But I mean, you take
Rag
a look
Man
at that.
Rules.
It was such an amazing job that taking like a talking magical monkey and not making it a joke. It's really easy to take those things and put them in a book and be like, hey, take a look at it, wink, wink, isn't this ridiculous, But they didn't. I mean, that's the easy way to go about doing these things. But they, it is funny. He is funny, but he's not funny like,
He's more funny
stupid.
Like your drunken, angry uncle or something funny.
Yeah, I mean, that's true for all those characters in that, like Ragman and Nightshade.
Well,
it's
kind of going back to what I said earlier is when I was growing up, DC was always kind of like the silly kids comics with heroes, the Hey Chum, and it amazes me that they've been able to take those same characters like Detective Chimp and you can read it and go, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. And it floors me, but somehow they've been able to make it work.
Yeah, it's Willingham did a great job. He took these characters that I'm a huge DC fan, and man, if you would have told me that I would have loved that beforehand, I would have laughed at you because the magic stuff isn't the stuff I like the most. But he wrote it in such a compelling way that you couldn't help but like these characters.
Now we've talked about Rand Thanagar War, and I understand now why it was important to what's going on in Infinite Crisis, but I think Tom summed it up best whenever I was talking to him earlier this week, is that if you read the first issue of Rand Thanagar War and the last issue, then that was pretty much all that you needed.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that happened between 2 and 5 were sort of, in my opinion, just kind of a mess. In the other minis, you could see things progress. You'd be like, each issue, you were like, oh, this is important, and things sort of built. Rand Thanagar, for this big epic space adventure, and failed kind of in a way, because they fit a lot in there, but they didn't fit a lot in there that had a lot of consequence, except for the beginning and the end. It just felt sort of empty in the middle.
It felt like they needed another miniseries to explain this one important event that happened, and then they made the rest of the mini.
If you've read the Adam Strange thing that came out right before that,
Planet Heist.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's it's such a nice story. Things progress, and there's space in it. Like, I don't want to bring up decompression, but like, man, Rand Thanagar needed something. Needed not to have a thousand things going on constantly within it.
Now, what was the importance? I didn't read the Rand Thanagar.
And since, you know, for the listeners out there, this is going to be fairly spoiler-filled. The big thing is that, was it Ran that moved into the same solar system as Thanagar?
Yes.
And we know now that was Superboy Prime.
It was Superboy
that was
Prime
doing
that moved the planet to create this war, and that was all a part of the plan
Alex
going
Luthor's.
Into the Infinite Crisis.
Yeah,
so
well,
it was really about Ran being moved around, which was part of Alexander Luthor's plan to with the whole like world shuffling thing that he's doing.
Well, I kind of figured. It was sort of a way to get focus off of what he was trying to hide. You know, he was able to do that. I mean, that causes confusion. It's sort of, you know, misdirection. It's like, okay, I'm going to cause these huge problems over here, and it'll get at least a certain amount of people involved in trying to...
You know, I think that was part of it, but Tom, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there something important about him having to, like, reposition, like, the center of the universe?
He had to make space.
Okay.
I think that was it, you know? Like, he had to make space for what he was going to do. And he needed to realign because, you know, there's a huge rift in space with his hands coming.
No, but you know what, Chris? You are right. Now that you've mentioned that, I do remember them in like, issue 3 or 4 of Infinite Crisis, him saying something about repositioning the universe so that he was now the center of the universe, which is an interesting...
Yeah.
Well, it used to be Oa.
Right, it used to be Oa, to give you an idea of how powerful Superboy Prime is, I mean, this guy's pushing planets around.
It's just like good old Earth One Superman.
Yeah, no kidding.
Exactly. So you're exactly right in that it was kind of a dual purpose. It was the major plan was Alexander Luthor rearranging the center of the universe, but also in getting all of these heroes to be involved in this war to take the spotlight off of what was going on.
Now,
on Earth,
to go back to Days of Vengeance, because
you love that book.
Villains United is the one that I really enjoyed the most.
I thought you turned into a huge Blue Devil fan.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I used to love the old Blue Devil book. I still have, I think, a complete run of the original Blue Devil book, and now they've sort of once again reinvented that character and made him much more serious and dangerous and interesting, as they did with all those, you know, all the characters. I really did like Day of Vengeance, but I also liked Villains United. But to go back to Day of Vengeance, let's just, you know, again kind of say, you know, Tom, if you can give us a little bit of why that was important in regards to Infinite Crisis and what happened in that series to tie into.
Oh, for Day of Vengeance?
Yeah.
What part of the plan was being fulfilled? Because I think it what we're looking back on is that each one of these minis and major events end up being parts of the plan that is happening in Infinite Crisis. What was the Day of Vengeance piece of the puzzle?
Well, it was Alex had managed to get Jean Loring, who was the, you know, murderer from Identity Crisis, since we're doing spoilers, so I just ruined it for anyone who didn't read that, but the Eclipso, you know, Diamond, and she became Eclipso, and she started influencing the Spectre, who hadn't had a human host at the time, and convincing the Spectre that magic was the source of all the evil in the world. So the Spectre goes about destroying magic, and a lot of magical characters, you know, got tossed aside. And basically, at the end, Shazam, who is the wizard that gave Captain Marvel's powers, is killed, and magic is kind of thrown into chaos. Dr. Fate also dies.
The Rock of Eternity is disintegrated.
Disintegrated, and magic is thrown completely into chaos, and you see it in a lot of the magical characters throughout all the crossovers.
Well, to go back to, you know, it was interesting, I thought, again, another example of, you know, them keeping everything together, is that, you know, with Eclipso and the Spectre not having a human host any longer, you know, that goes back to Hal Jordan's return as, you know, Green Lantern, and it's just another example of how they, you know, back then even they were planning this all out, or at least, if nothing, if they weren't planning it, they used, you know, it again to keep everything tightly wound up into a very comprehensive story.
Well, you look at what DC has done, and they're either master retconners or they're master planners or both, and it just seems to work, and that's to their credit. Let's look at one of the other major minis, and that was the OMAC project. Tom, have you read OMAC?
Yes, I have, and I enjoyed it greatly, actually. And I'm not a huge Batman fan, so that's saying a lot.
I thought it was interesting in that all the other minis didn't deal with really the Trinity characters, but OMAC was definitely a Batman series.
Well, it's literally his paranoia put into physical form, you know, in the book, as he creates a satellite to spy on everyone because he's been so paranoid since Identity Crisis about people messing with other people's minds, and he loses control of the spy satellite, and Checkmate has control of it, and Max Lord, who's in charge of Checkmate, also has mental control over Superman, so it has very interesting implications as Wonder Woman resorts to killing Max Lord to stop his control of Superman.
Which actually doesn't happen in OMAC, but an OMAC tie-in in Wonder Woman that, if you're able to find that issue on eBay, you're luckier than me. But
if you get it in the trade, they have the last issue of Sacrifice, and then...
And they also reprinted that issue of Wonder Woman
okay.
That you can probably find.
You don't
but
need
but I think it's pretty
three.
Widely known that
yeah, I mean you don't you,
what Wonder Woman did and this is where I'm kind of confused. Does OMAC fit into Alexander Luthor's plan?
Yes. Because you see, the satellite is what he uses in the newest issue that just came out to hit Earth 2 Superman with the beam that separates him out, and all of a sudden all the different Earths start popping up everywhere. And he's the one that
gets... Okay, that's where I was confused. Keeping all this stuff up in the air and figuring out how each mini, each event, each series is tying together, it really makes my brain hurt. But it's amazing how they've been able to do it.
Yeah, that it was sort of you didn't know how that series really tied in until later on. I mean, you knew with Batman and Brother Eye and his feeling, you know, his feelings of isolation and being, you know, driven further away from the rest of the heroes in the universe and becoming more and more paranoid and you felt that, and it was a good tie-in to the previous series. I mean, it was a good, you know, it tied into that, but you weren't sure until later on how it was affecting, you know, Infinite Crisis or what was it, how it was involved in it. But then you see later how it appears that Maxwell Lord was just another pawn in Alex Luthor's game of what he's, you know, trying to accomplish.
It's amazing because what I'm feeling, and coming from the standpoint of traditionally a Marvel fan or an indie fan, what I've been able to get from DC is that when someone coughs, it means something. And across the entire universe, that is just amazing. From someone that, you know, I work in marketing and understanding how hard it is to tie different things together and make it work well, how they've been able to get the entire universe to hit in step on the same beat is absolutely amazing. I don't want to I don't want to build it up too much because I think there's a lot of hyperbole out there regarding DC, but what they've done cross-universe is really mind-blowing.
Well, the thing that it, you know, that amazes me too, what I appreciate is, you know, looking at it from a writing perspective, I always thought one of the hardest things it had to be trying to write a character like Reed Richards or, you know, Lex Luthor or Brainiac or something, you know, where they're supposed to be these, you know, superior intelligences that, you know, obviously are smarter than anyone that's ever lived. How do you write that type of character? But now
if you're not the smartest person
on the planet, you know, yeah. But you look at this now and you have, you know, Alexander Luthor, and now you look at the depth of his plan and how brilliant it, you know, it really would be. That's, you know, a character that intelligent could do this, you know, because it is so complex and so far-reaching, and everything that he's put together that has worked out, it really is a testament to all the writers at DC and that, you know, the editorial staff putting that together.
Well, that's what's mind-blowing to me, is that everyone looks at Geoff Johns as kind of being the center cog in this, and I don't think that there's any doubt about that, but you look at Gail Simone and Greg Rucka and, oh God, who are some of the other major...
Well, don't forget about Grant Morrison, I think, is playing a big part of this too. He was signed on sort of as the person to lead the charge forward after this, and I think he may be having a lot to do with it.
I think that we as comic fans have looked back on great series in the past and said, oh my God, that was a great run, or that was a real masterpiece in comics, if it's, you know, say a Frank Miller run on Daredevil or whatever, but this is the first time that I felt a company as a whole with multiple writers tying things together where you're going to be able to say, wow, that was a group of people that created something that is going to have long-lasting effects into this universe. It's an amazing accomplishment, and we'll see what happens post-crisis, which is what I want to talk about next, and that is 1 year later. And for, you know, I think everyone knows that after the crisis is over, the DCU is jumping forward a year, and then there's the DC 52, which is going to fill in the blanks. Now, I know that Tom has picked up a couple 1 year later titles. What are you seeing right now as to the direction that the universe is taking with that?
They're doing, it's good introductory stories. You're not going to get any, you know,
secrets.
Idea of what's going to happen. Yeah, but it's...
You're getting the appetizer and not the steak right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're nice stories within themselves, and they give little hints, like people talking about what's happened in the after this year that we've had. Stuff like that, which
right.
Sounds kind of stupid now that I just said it out loud. But, it's, you know, I got The Outsiders, and I got, which I've seen some people didn't really like it, but, you know, the new Captain Boomerang is in it, so.
Well, you said that the JSA was very good.
Yeah, it was really nice, because if you hadn't read the JSA, you could have read that and been like, okay. It did a nice job of having a story that propelled itself, but also let you see a little bit about the characters. I'm going to spoil it a little bit, but part of it is these ghosts start appearing to various characters, and that's part of the plot, is that why are we seeing these ghosts? And it involves the Gentleman Ghost, which is such an awesome character, you know, to find a cool way to bring back in. But not only are you seeing the ghost propelling the story, but seeing the ghost tells you something about this character. So if this is the first time you've been reading it, you can say, oh, okay, I know this about this character. You have something to latch onto, and you're not just dropped into, you know, an ongoing story. You get a tiny little hint of origin. So
that's cool. You know, I would like to be able to spoil the action comic, or no, it's not action, it's Adventures of Superman, but there's not a single issue in the city of Chicago left of that
one.
Yeah. It disappeared off of shelves. Sal, were you able to finally find one?
I did. There was a shop.
You found two, right?
Well, actually, I didn't pick it up. It wasn't a 1 year later title.
No, it's just the end of this.
It's the end of
Superman.
It's an Infinite Crisis tie-in, but it's not a 1 year later. I thought initially that it was, so I flipped through it and I ended up not picking it up. Because I hadn't been reading that leading into it.
It's completely sold out in Chicago. Completely sold out on Diamond. And that's probably, as we look at the state of the DCU, can anybody ever recall this much excitement about a universe as a whole? And I got to talk to Mark Beatty over at Dark Tower about how this is impacting sales, but I haven't seen this much excitement about an event or the general take of a universe.
Well, remember also, though, that, the sellouts are not necessarily... I mean, I talked to three different shops about the one-year later titles, and they were either sold out of them or they had received damaged books, so they had to wait to get new ones in. But I think a lot of them sort of... under-ordered. I think they weren't expecting people, because they all three shops said they kept seeing people come in the door asking for those that they had never seen before. Either people from other shops
awesome.
Yeah, which is, just pretty amazing. But the one thing, I read the JSA one, I read the Detective Comics one, and what else? I think there was one other one that I read.
Aquaman?
No, I didn't read the Aquaman.
I read that one.
But the thing I got from it, and I enjoyed them both, but like I said, you're not getting a whole lot of information. You're getting a little bit, they're hinting around as to, we've missed, after what happened 12 months ago or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what I felt from both of them, and I spent a little bit of time thinking about it too, about how are they doing this? They're going to have this 52. They're going to have, the 52 project or whatever you want to call it. And it's going to be every week they're going to have a new book, and a year from now we're going to finally know what the heck happened in the last year. But at the same time, you're going to be reading 1 year into the future in all these current books. And I'm sitting there going, how are they doing this? How is this going to work out in the end? Because at the end of it all, you're going to know what happened in that year, but you're going to be 2 years removed from it.
If they're able to pull it off... It hurts my head how much planning has gone into this.
Well, I think
if they're able to, across every DC title, pull off that with 52 and not give away major plot points until the exact week or month that it's supposed to across the entire universe, I can't fathom how much planning that takes.
Well, it's going to be impressive, and I think, but it goes back to what I said initially, was I think what they're trying to accomplish is setting a tone with all these books and with all these characters to move forward from. And that's what I kind of got from the JSA and from the Detective Comics, was it wasn't like there were these incredibly radical changes that took place, but just sort of this reestablishment of this is where we are now and this is how we're going to go forward from here. I mean, what happened, with the detective book, there's characters that are brought back I don't want to spoil it, but, there's some characters that are there that haven't been around, and just sort of this attitude and feeling of, okay, we're moving forward from this and this is what it's going to be like. And same with the JSA. The JSA was a completely different book in my eyes as to what the JSA was before this and to what, like, Batman was. It didn't have the same tone at all.
But did it fit? Did it fit in the feel of the universe?
I don't know yet. It's hard to say. I don't know, because you don't know what the state of the universe is. It had its own... the JSA to me felt a little more... Silver Age-ish, with the Gentleman Ghost coming back and
they're
just...
They're not on Earth 2, are they?
I don't think so.
You don't know for sure.
You don't know, though. You don't know for sure. That's the interesting thing. But if you read those two books, they both of them, I thought, were written to set a tone, to set a standard and completely different from one another. I didn't feel that there was really any, you know, any crossover between reading, you know, Detective Comics and reading JSA. They were completely different books. They both talked about this, you know, what happened in the last year, but the feel of both those books were completely different. They were their own titles. And both good. I enjoyed them both, and I could really see, you know, going forward, you know, from them. But it was just interesting to kind of look at that and say, well, you know, are they kind of setting that up as, you know, as this is how it's going to be from now on? And I think that's what they're trying to do.
AroundComics.com, your source for discussion, news, and reviews about your favorite comics and creators. New podcasts available every Monday. Go to www.aroundcomics.com.
Okay, let's come back with some final thoughts here. This is obviously a huge topic. I think that people have already talked thousands and thousands of man hours on this subject, and we could keep going. But let's wrap it up. Tom, go ahead and give me your final thoughts on where the universe is, where you think it's going, and what you think about it.
As someone who's read DC Comics for a long time, this is the most excited I've been since I've become jaded about comic book reading, you know, about 10 years ago. And, right now, they're writing for the people that have been reading for a very long time, but having read the 1 year later books, I think they're going to do a really good job of making it a place for people that haven't, you know, been reading DC Comics. And it's pretty exciting to hear that shop owners notice people coming in asking for those titles who they've never seen before. So, also, of course, you know, these people that are going to pick these new 1 year later up, you know, that haven't read DC before, maybe get interested and read the old stuff, and then they'll come back and read Infinite Crisis and get it. So it's just really exciting because it's one time that I feel like things are really going to happen, you know, like you're going to see a change. You're going to see a tone change in a book, and it's going to be interesting. And I'm just really excited because I've loved all these characters since I was a kid, and for a long time I didn't think they were being done justice. So it's nice to have a couple years of stories that, you know, justify these characters.
All right, Sal, you look at comics with a very discerning eye. Your take on the DCU?
You know, I agree a lot with what Tom said. I've been enjoying it so far. I used to read a lot of DC, and then I, too, got jaded with it. A lot of the stuff that they were doing and fell off from it. I picked back into it probably a few months before the whole identity crisis thing started, and have been enjoying it ever since, and I am really excited to see where this is going. Probably the most, you know, impressive thing for me is that they've really given these characters so much more depth, and made them, in their own right, you know, all very interesting characters. And I'm very interested to see where it's going to go. I think they are going to, you know, wrap this up with the idea of people will be able to jump on after the whole 1 year later, as long as they keep this perspective for at least a few years, as long as this isn't, you know, just a fly-by-night thing that happens and then they go back to, you know, the way things were before, or off on, you know, completely different tangents, if they can keep this sort of quality and, you know, integrity with their writing and with the characters, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see where this goes, because I think this is some of the best, you know, superhero stuff that's going on right now, and has gone on in a long time in the DCU. And so I'm excited about it. I can't wait to see where it goes. They've got me hooked. I mean, I'm buying more and more stuff because they just keep coming out with good stuff, and it all ties in, and it all ties in so well. And I think that's sort of the key, is that, you know, they're doing this huge crossover event, but it doesn't, you know, I didn't read the Rand Thangar War. I didn't care about it. It didn't matter. I didn't need to. The stuff I did read, I really enjoyed, and it's all been important. It wasn't like throwaway. You know, you get all that, you know, a lot of crossover events where, you know, yeah, it has the name of the crossover. Secret Wars 2, that's a perfect example. You know, that Secret Wars 2 logo was on every single Marvel book that, you know, that came out for 6 months before Secret Wars 2. But half of, you know, most of those stories didn't have anything to do with Secret Wars 2. Everything that they've done in this run with a, you know, Infinite Crisis, there's something involving, you know, the whole big picture, and that's refreshing.
I agree, and I'm going to be really quick with mine because I think there's been enough people that have talked about how great a job that DC is doing. It's we hear about it on every fan forum and throughout you know, all of the comics news out there. Probably the biggest compliment I can give to it is that I'm a lifelong Marvel fan. I love indie books, and DC has always been something that I've read off and on, and it interested me in a moderate way. If there was a writer in DC that I liked, I'd pick it up. But
Greg Rucka.
Love the Greg Rucka. But from a moderate DC fan, I look at what they're doing as a whole, and it absolutely blows me away. The planning from, you know, you're talking years, multiple writers, multiple artists, the amount of secrecy that has been required to keep this all from, you know, leaking out. It is the closest thing to a comic company-wide perfect continuity that I've ever seen in comics. It's going to become the boilerplate in how to do a comics universe. So that's my take on it. So.
Hey, you know, I just wanted to mention too, if anyone wants more information about sort of the state of the DC universe and how everything is tied into everything else, there's a great website out there called Sequart. It's www.sequart.com, and they're a news and reviews website. But they've done like 40 or 50 articles on every single book that has come out from Identity Crisis till now. And also they've gone back and looked at stuff, you know, like the death of Donna Troy and, you know, Adam Strange, the, you know, the Planet Heist stuff, and how it related to, or how it relates to Infinite Crisis. So if you're really interested in checking that stuff out, I would say go to www.sequart.com. They have a real comprehensive set of articles on it.
Absolutely. There is way too much to go over in the DCU in one episode of Around Comics. So I think we're going to finish up today's topic right there, and that will lead us into Wired to Wire comic news with Brian Salazar.
Wired.
On Monday, Fred Gallagher announced he was moving Mega Tokyo from Dark Horse Comics to DC Comics' CMX line. Rumor has it that Dark Horse didn't even know about the move until it was announced at the Wildstorm panel at the New York Comic Con. Gallagher said, "Dark Horse is a wonderful publisher and have done an excellent job printing the first three volumes, but in the end, I decided that there was a lot of potential for my work, both current and future, with DC CMX. It was a tough decision because I have great respect for both publishers." At the manga panel at the New York City Comic Con, Dark Horse editor Carl Horn announced that the company was planning to double its output of manga titles in 2006, total of more than 70, and expand the range of Dark Horse releases to encompass all of the major manga genres. Victor Del Sante, the unofficial press liaison for Speakeasy Comics, announced the publisher would be closing their doors. In a website announcement, he said, "As unofficial public relations for Speakeasy Comics, I feel it is my duty to inform everyone that as of 3:30 p.m. today, Speakeasy Comics has shut its doors and will not be publishing comics for, at the very least, the rest of the year. Most, if not all, creators have been contacted and informed. If I'm not mistaken, all books scheduled to ship in March will ship. April and May books are up in the air, while June books are canceled." Marvel Comics and Top Cow Entertainment announced that the first collaboration between them will take place in Amazing Spider-Man number 530 and number 531, with Top Cow's Tyler Kirkham taking over the penciling for the two issues. Our strategic partnership with Marvel Comics is one of the best moves Top Cow has ever made, says Top Cow president Matt Hawkins. The heart of the deal between the two companies revolved around 36 issues of Marvel Comics with art by Top Cow artists over the next 2 or 3 years. 6 of those books will feature art by Mark Silvestri alongside fan-favorite writer Brian Michael Bendis. In addition, Silvestri will also be drawing 18 covers for Marvel. DC Comics revealed that a crossover special between Todd McFarlane's Spawn and DC's Batman was in the works. The crossover special will reportedly be produced by McFarlane and McFarlane employee Greg Capullo. McFarlane may be writing or co-writing, with Capullo supplying the art. Curiously, the comic book special will reportedly be accompanied by a statue of the two characters, one that somehow ties into the comic book's narrative. The statue will be co-produced by DC Direct, DC's Toy Wing, and McFarlane Toys, McFarlane's highly successful toy company. DB Pro announced that they have signed a deal with New York Times best-selling author Laurel K. Hamilton to obtain the exclusive rights to adapt the popular multi-million copy-selling Anita Blank Vampire Hunter novels into a monthly comic book series. Laura K. Hamilton is one of the most popular authors on the planet right now, said Ernst Dobble, president of Dobble Brothers Production. She's constantly ranked as one of the top-selling writers on Amazon, and her latest books in the Anita Blake series have been smash-hit successes. We're thrilled to be partnering with her to bring these novels into the graphic medium, and we know that this series will appeal to anyone who is a fan of fantasy, horror, romance, or adventure. The first book in the series, Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter in Guilty Pleasures, will hit shelves in June 2006. The adaptation will also be published in 2 graphic novel volumes, available respectively in January and July 2007. Boom Studios and Intel, the computer processor manufacturer, announced the creation of Shiri Secret, a 20-page graphic novel designed to promote Intel Viv technology for entertainment PCs. Focusing on telling the story of a suburban American family, Shiri Secret follows a storyline modeled after a television daytime drama. As the tale unfolds, the features and benefits of an Intel Viv technology entertainment PC are spotlighted. Shiri Secret will make its public debut at the upcoming Cinequest Film Festival March 1st through the 12th in San Jose, California. Virgin Comics LLC announced today that they have recruited Seymour Miles as Senior Vice President of Sales and Publishing, responsible for the production, distribution, sales, and marketing of Virgin Comic titles throughout North America and the United Kingdom. Miles will also oversee advertising sales for Virgin Comics publications. Virgin Comics will launch during 2006 with the publication of 3 comic imprints: Shakti, a line of Indian-infused titles, Director's Cut featuring stories developed in conjunction with Shikhar Kapoor, John Woo, and other filmmakers, and Maverick, produced with leading writers and other leading creators. The Teen Titans head to Japan in their first animated movie, Teen Titans Tokyo, airing in late fall. When a high-tech ninja attacks Titans Tower, Robin, Starfire, Cyborg, Raven, and Beast Boy spring into action. Robin finds out that their attacker was sent by a mysterious and menacing Japanese criminal known as Bushugen, and the Teen Titans travel to Tokyo to track the villain down. 3 Viz Manga appeared in USA Today's best-selling book list for the week ending February 26th. Most notable was Naruto Volume 9, which ranked 29th, the highest ever rank achieved by a manga. The volume was ranked in position 147 the previous week. The other manga titles in book list this week were Rurouni Kenshin, Volume 24, in position 116, and Death Note, Volume 4, in position 118. Marvel Comics announced that writer Mark Carey and artist Pasquale Ferry, who did the 2 Ultimate Fantastic Four X-Men specials, will be the regular team on Ultimate Fantastic Four following the departure of that title's current creators, writer Mark Millar and artist Greg Land. The new team will debut with issue number 33, and their run will feature appearances by Ultimate Thanos, Ultimate Ronan, and others. These have been your top comic book headlines. For more information on these stories and others, visit us at www.aroundcomics.com.
All right, that's your comics news. Looks like a lot of news out of Tokyo and manga this week. We'll bring it a little bit closer to home. The news about Dark Horse, they are going to double their manga output to 70 titles. Is this an idea of things to come? Tom?
Maybe. I don't know much about manga, so I just gave you the worst, most vague answer I could.
Well, I mean, every week we get more and more manga news, and that seems to be what's out there on the wires. So it just kind of becomes more and more apparent to me that manga is becoming more of the mainstream and not the underground in American comics. Is this just kind of a calm before the storm with Dark Horse announcing this, that our comics are going to go more and more to the manga format?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you look at that other story about the USA Today bestseller list. I mean, you have three top, 100 or whatever bestseller books are manga books. You know, you don't see any Marvel or DC comic, trades in that list. They're doing something right. I think the rest of the industry obviously knows that. But at the same time, the story about Dark Horse, it may have been sort of a reaction to, Megatokyo leaving Dark Horse for DC's...
The DC announcement.
So, I don't know how far to look into that. But it is interesting that, if they're going to have over 70 titles, next year, that's a huge shift in
absolutely
what they're doing.
We had alluded a little bit earlier in the show that this is a four-part series, talking back to the DC. We're going to talk about Marvel, and then we're going to talk about Indie, and then we're going to dedicate a show to manga. It's becoming more and more important in American comics, and I think we're going to take a look at our manga really comics, for the traditional comic book fan, or is it a completely different creature? So we're going to dedicate an entire episode to that. So we'll move on. I want to talk about the Speakeasy closing its doors. A friend of the show, Steve Bryant, is an artist for Athena Voltaire, and which was printed by Speakeasy. Once again, another small comic book publisher is closing its doors. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Depressing. Because, no one gets into publishing comics because they think they're going to make $1 million. So, these people, it's someone's dream that's kind of taken a turn for the worst. So that's always kind of depressing.
Well, what's really depressing about it is that the guy that, owned Speakeasy was a multimillionaire before, he got into it. So if he can't keep it running, that's sad. But, from what I've heard, I know Warren Ellis spoke out about it, and a few other people have spoke out about it quite a bit, and they've all sort of said that, they made the classic mistakes that new publishers make in that they put out too many titles without any real solid marketing plan. They had a couple of titles with some small success, and on that they just started pumping out titles without really any plan to get them into stores, and that's really what led to their downfall. But it is sad to see another small publisher go, because
it's too bad, because Speakeasy was putting out some good titles. Now, one of the big knocks that I had heard on them is, everything that we basically complain about Marvel and DC is that there were late titles. A Speakeasy book would hit the market, and they were hitting with a lot of them, but they weren't hitting with a monthly frequency. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the quickest way to ward off consumers is to come out with a good book and then not come out with it with the next issue a month later. Whenever you're 2 and 3 and 4 or 6 months in between issues, that's going to kill your consumer market.
Absolutely.
So, at the Marvel and Top Cow, I'm not exactly for sure how that partnership breaks down, whether it's Top Cow artists being able to come over and work for Marvel without the exclusive or whatever. I do like the idea of Silvestri doing some work at Marvel again. So any thoughts on that, guys?
I think it'll be interesting. I mean, you know, it is going to be basically artists coming over and doing fill-ins and cover work and that kind of thing. You know, Silvestri and I'd like to see. I will enjoy seeing Tyler Kirkham try and do a couple of Spider-Man issues because I do enjoy his art. But is it a prelude to maybe a more serious relationship between Marvel and Top Cow? You know, a more involved, maybe.
And this is something I'll ask Tom. As far, you know, they make a big deal about cover artists. I keep seeing this in, you know, previews or Wizard or whatever. It's like, you know, Michael Turner cover. I stopped buying comics based on the cover a long time ago. Am I in the minority? Yeah. Do you buy a comic because it has a McFarlane cover or whatever?
Yes.
No. Liar, of course.
Liar.
I want a book of just covers.
They have those.
They do have the them.
Cover, I want a hardcover.
It's like you could put anything on the cover, and if it's a good, you know, like, I know a book is crap, but it has a sweet cover. I'm not gonna pick it up just to have the cover.
No,
books cost $3. I'm not gonna spend $3 for a Michael Turner poorly body position drawing. You know,
well, now, like, don't knock on Michael Turner, but I think what I'm getting at is that and I like some of his stuff, but well, I think what I'm getting at is that, you know, we're all in our 30s, and Marvel, DC, Image, we remember the 90s. We remember the whole cover game. Don't you try and trick us again, because we remember, and we tell the younger kids too.
I'm 27.
Yeah, but don't forget one thing, that you may not buy it because of the cover, but you might not buy it because of the cover. You may not, you know what I mean? And what I mean by that is if a book doesn't have a cover that you are attracted to, you may never pick it up long enough to see, you know, if it is something you want to buy.
I guess, kind of. But
maybe that's true if it's an indie book, or if it's something that's, you know, a minor publisher. But, you know, if it's Amazing Spider-Man, I really don't care who draws the cover. If I know that, you know, Straczynski's writing it and Romita is drawing the interiors, I don't really care what the cover looks like.
Well, that, once again, that's us. We're old and jaded, and, you know.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
There's plenty of people that I think...
There's some youngsters out there right now furiously searching for awesome covers.
Exactly. You know, speaking of awesome covers in the 90s and all that stuff, we got a perfect story here. Spawn and Batman. I could honestly not care less about Spawn and Batman.
It's probably going to cost you $30 because it's coming with a statue.
I don't care. I don't care. We talked about DC and everything awesome that they are doing, and breaking away from everything that was really crappy about, you know, the 90s. And Spawn and Batman, I could give a crap. Am I old and jaded?
There is...
Yes.
...a worse... They could have somehow found a way to squeeze the Punisher into that account.
Spawn, Punisher, Batman crossover.
A Wolverine shows up on the last page.
Yeah,
everyone be happy.
It'll sell a ton of copies. There. You know, I we could talk about this being such an irrelevant marketing push to just sell issues, you know, till the cows come home, and it's going to sell, you know, like, this will sell 100 times more than any single issue of Local or Walking Dead, and that just pisses me off. But
yeah, but you know what?
You just need a Local that takes place with Spawn in it.
You know,
yeah.
But you know what? What would really sell that book? It would be the easiest thing to sell, you know, a couple hundred thousand copies, is if Todd McFarlane actually drew something again, you know, instead of designing statues.
You get the statue.
Walking
Dead, Punisher, Spawn, Batman.
I'm gonna
Local is supermarket.
Yeah. I'm gonna raise a challenge to our listeners, and we are on iTunes now, so there's scads more of you than there were in previous episodes that we've had. So welcome to the show. But when you see Spawn, Batman come out, put it down, walk to your left, and ask your shop owner if he carries Brian Woods Local, and pick that up, or Walking Dead, or something else.
You have more listeners now.
There are more people out there, believe it or not.
And local does have cool covers too.
Yeah.
And interior. Brian Wood's that guy amazes me with it, like some of the design stuff he does.
He's my absolute favorite creator of 2006 so far.
All right.
Period. More Japan stuff. They've been sending comics over to us with manga. Now we're sending our heroes over there. Teen Titans go to Japan. Are they going to draw them with Bug Eyes?
Well, you look at the... I think it's just a takeoff of the Cartoon Network cartoon. I think they're using that same... So it's already sort of manga-ized.
Okay.
And to some degree, anyway.
We also saw some stuff from Boom Studios. Brian, you've turned into a fan of Boom. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, you know, I don't know a ton about Boom Studios, other than it seems like almost Image-like in the early days of Image. It's a bunch of creators getting together and doing their own thing, and the difference is they're putting out, you know, really good quality stuff right away. I picked up Zombie World number 1, which was an anthology. It was I think 6 short zombie stories. And yeah, you know, there's a ton of zombie stuff out there, but this was all different takes on, you know, more like short stories, but all in one way or another about zombies. And it was fun, interesting little read. Good artwork. I also picked up from them Hero Squared,
mm-hmm,
which
yes.
is I can't think of the guys. The guys that did JLA.
Giffen DeMatteis.
Yeah.
So they did Planetary Brigade.
Yeah, Planetary Brigade. I think it's some of the same characters.
Yep, it's the same.
And it was funny, you know, real outrageous kind of JLA comedy thing. And they're putting out good stuff. I think they're going to be a force to be reckoned with here.
Well, hopefully they don't go the way of Speakeasy. So, Boom, if you're listening, keeping those issues come out and get them out every month, and we will continue to buy them. That should wrap up Wire to Wire Comic News. Let's move on to Top of the Stack. That's right. It is Top of the Stack, our chance to tell you what we have been reading in the last week and let you know what we think about it. I'll start out my Top of the Stack this week. This is a book that a lot of people know about. I hope a lot of people are reading, but if they are not, this is the time to hop on. It is called Ex Machina. It is written by Brian K. Vaughan. It comes out under the Wildstorm imprint, has a retail of $2.99. Ex Machina is a very untraditional superhero story. The main character does have superpowers, but that is without a doubt not the focus of the book. This is a title that is filled with political undertones, with a lot of intrigue, supernatural superpowers, a little bit of everything. We could dedicate an entire episode talking to Ex Machina, but I will tell you that it is one of Brian K. Vaughan's best books, and Brian K. Vaughan is definitely one of the better writers in comics. If you have not checked it out, please do so. If you like politics, if you like superpowers, if you like mixed horror, it is all in there. This is a book that offers a lot to a lot of different readers, so please check out Ex Machina. Sal, what is your Top of the Stack?
Well, mine's a little different this week. I picked up Girls by the Luna Brothers, the first trade paperback. It collects the first 6 issues of Girls. It is Volume 1, Conception. And, you know, before I picked it, there was a lot of buzz about this. I had heard a lot of people really talking about this book and the Luna Brothers' other book, Ultra. I think Ultra was their first book. I had read a few issues of Ultra. It wasn't really something I enjoyed. I don't know. I just didn't get into it for whatever reason. But I did end up picking this up over the weekend and read it. And it was completely different than what I thought it was going to be. It was absolutely nothing like I thought it was going to be. It is written and layouts by Joshua Luna and art by Jonathan Luna. They're brothers, put out by Image Comics. It basically tells us, it starts off with a small town called Pennystown. It doesn't say where. It's a very small little rural town with a population of about 65. And we get to know the main character. We're quickly introduced to the main character, Ethan, who's probably mid-20s, sort of a little bit nebbishness about him, but likable nonetheless. Very fascinated with girls, as anyone else is. And Ethan has a problem with girls. He doesn't understand them. He can't communicate with them. He's always sort of having a hard time understanding it, and it really shows up in the very beginning. The Luna brothers write almost ironically. They play with words a lot, and it's fun to read. They, in between the conversations of the characters, the character will say one thing and mean something else, and you're sort of stuck trying to figure it out panel to panel. But anyway, Ethan goes on. One night he gets very drunk at the local bar and ends up sort of yelling at all the women in town because he's just fed up at that point with a lot of things that have gone on in his life. At the end of that, he gets tossed out of the bar by the local sheriff, and immediately there's this loud boom heard. And it stops everybody, and the rain stops, and it's just this really strange event. Well, he gets up and gets in his car, and he's driving home, and he almost runs over someone. All of a sudden, someone appears in the middle of the road, and he almost runs this person over. He gets out of his car, and it's this very beautiful, naked woman standing in the middle of the road. I don't want to go too any further, because I don't want to spoil anything about this book. Just suffice it to say, it goes from there to completely different than what you might imagine it would. It's a very science fictionish sort of story in some regards. It almost plays, or pays homage to some science fiction stuff, but it's all about these characters, and it's very indie in one way, that it's all about the characters and their own emotions and personalities. But then you have these other elements that come into this town, and at the end of the run, at the end of the six issues, I immediately wanted to go and pick up the rest of the books that are out there. I think they're on issue 11 or 12 right now, so I'm desperately awaiting the second trade. But it was a great read, and the art's fantastic, and the layouts are great. The they really know what they're doing. I mean, it's not hodgepodge or thrown together. They certainly plan their layouts and what they're trying to accomplish with the story with them. So I highly recommend Girls. It was fun, entertaining, and I look forward to seeing more from the Luna brothers.
I keep hearing good things about Girls and the Luna brothers. One of the things on the art, and I'll compare this to Ex Machina, Tony Harris does the art on Ex Machina, and that with the Luna brothers, it's something that you're going to look at that you haven't seen in other books. And I love that, in that you have something that is beautiful to look at, but is different than anything else that you've seen. Tom, what do you have for your top of the stack this week?
I figured since we're talking about DC, I would pick a Marvel book that people aren't buying. So
I was going to say, if you said Infinite Crisis, I was going to hunt you down.
No, it's too obvious of a joke. I'm picking The Thing by Dan Slott and Andrea... Oh, I'm going to screw this up probably. DeVito, looks like how it's pronounced, but that's just a guess. And it is a really fun Marvel book to read, especially now that the tone in a lot of these companies has gotten kind of serious. It's nice to find a book that kind of plays around with continuity, but is, still well written. In the third issue, just something that was just unbelievably awesome was he's fighting a Hulk robot. The Thing is fighting a Hulk robot and a whole bunch of Hulk robots that look like the Hulk from all the different incarnations that he's been written. And then at one point, a bunch of Thing robots come out that are all the different incarnations of the Thing. And it's just little stuff like that, little nods to the past, but still, you know, you can follow it if you don't know a ton of Marvel. And it's you know, it's really fun, and, you know, when the FF show up in it, you know, it's written, you know, better than how the Fantastic Four is usually written in the main book, you know. You get to see, you know, the Human Torch acts like sort of, you know, a pompous jerk, and Reed Richards is sort of, you know, absent-minded and, you know, Mr. Wise, you know, man on top of everything. But it's just, it's fun. I read it, you know, the last issue had Lockjaw and the Inhumans, and it had a scene with the Thing wearing a shirt and pants, which I think is always, like, awesome to see someone do that, you know?
Like, yeah, Tom, I'm going to jump in here real quick. One of the things that Sal and I have talked about, and then you and I talked about, is that how serious comics have been, and it just seems really hard to find fun, just, you know, books like we used to read whenever we were kids, and it's such this weird double-edged sword of, you know, oh, we don't want campy silly, but, you know, why can't books be like they used to be? And it's something that we keep riding back and forth, and Dan Slott just seems to have that pegged down in how to write a fun book that is still good to read.
Yeah, well, like, and
I was going to say, like you were saying before, Chris, you know, he thumbs his nose at the industry, you know, standard of you know, seriousness and dark and continuity laden, you know, but he's a talented enough writer that he can get away with it.
Yeah, he's good and he's able to pull it off, but he's fun. Everyone I've talked to said that She-Hulk was one of the best ongoing series in the last couple years.
Yeah, I was going to pick that, but the Thing's sales are incredibly low and I'm worried that it'll get canceled, so I picked
Poor
the
Ben.
Thing. Yeah. It's better than the Fantastic Four book. Like, you know, it's the characters are written better, you know, which is weird, at least in my opinion. I read this and characters show up and Dan Slott has a way of making them serious characters, but, you know, even the most serious person you know in real life does funny things or acts in a funny way sometimes, intentional or not. So I don't know. Grim and gritty isn't real. You know? No more real than funny things happening.
He made suicide funny in jail or in GLA, the Great Lakes. Yeah, you know?
He has a way of doing, you know, taking those little things and making, yeah.
You know, Dan Slott has started to become a favorite writer by a lot of people. Do you think that Marvel's going to catch on to this and give him a serious book, or would that kind of ruin it? Do you want to see him continue to write books where he has the freedom to kind of stay funny?
I think so. It'd be weird to see him do, you know, like Amazing
Punisher.
Spider-Man, because I don't think people want that, or people don't want the Punisher, but
I bet you he could do a Fantastic Four, though, because that's a different
different
kind of book, you know. He could do that adventure and you know,
I think he would be awesome on Spider-Man. I think he would write an awesome Spider-Man.
I think he would write anything awesome. It's just, would people, you know, I could see people throwing, you know, a hissy fit because all of a sudden Amazing Spider-Man is, you know, like, people get freaked out by books that are supposed to be funny. Like, people are like, oh, you know, comics aren't supposed to be funny.
Comic.
You know, but there's a difference between, the comic book's not supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be very serious, and Spider-Man's supposed to have tons of problems. But you can
maybe
sophisticated
you put him on
humor.
Well, maybe you put him on a book like Friendly Neighborhood after Peter David is done.
Yeah, well, isn't that supposed to
like,
be?
Yeah, you know, the funny, you know, Spider-Man, because, you know, that's been always the thing with Spider-Man is that he's always very clever and very quick, and you have kind of the funny witticisms that he brings to it, and I think Dan Slott would do that to a T.
Yeah, but it might just ruin him. You know what? Let him stick with these B-level or these, you know, secondary characters. I can't call the Thing a B-level character, but
yeah, he is.
Those are. It is clobbering time.
That's right, baby.
I'm sorry. The Fantastic Four are Marvel's first family, but they I don't know. FF has a lot of problems, and that's a subject for another show. But thank you guys for your top of the stack. I do want to mention a couple things before we wrap up the show. Number one, this will be our first episode that I think is officially released on iTunes before its initial release. So if you are new to the show as a listener, thank you. We appreciate you taking the time to hear what we think. If you would like to contact us, please send us an email at info@aroundcomics.com. Let us know. Or you can visit us on our forum. Please go to aroundcomics.com. Click on the forum. You will notice that you'll be redirected to the Comic Geek Speak forum. That's our good buddies over at Comic Geek Speak, another wonderful podcast, which you have probably already heard of. Please vote for us at Podcast Alley. All those votes really matter to us. Sal, do you have any other announcements or requests for everyone?
No, just send us your emails. We'd love to read some listener emails on the show. If you got any comments or I know we've had a lot of comments on the forum, but I'd love to have people actually email stuff that we can read, or just say hello, or tell us what you like or don't like or whatever. Just send us your emails and we'll read them on the show.
I'll email you guys next week.
Not you.
Oh. to recap, we talked about it a little bit at the beginning of the show and then a little bit later. We are starting a 4-week event here. It's Crisis on Infinite Around Comics. No, not really. Today we talked about the state of the DC Universe. We're going to talk about the state of the Marvel Universe next week. Then we're going to come back and talk about indie comics and how the entire indie world has evolved and changed. And then we're going to dedicate an episode to manga. If you have any thoughts or comments on any of those, please send them to us, and we would love to read them on the air. But I think that will wrap up another episode of Around Comics. Thank you for listening, and check us out again next week.
If you would like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. For that and the latest in comics news and opinions, go to www.aroundcomics.com. Music for this show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next week, where the panel will change, but our mission stays the same, bringing you the best in discussion, news, and reviews in and around comics.